This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, more than 100 schools closed. South Australia braces for catastrophic fire conditions. The latest snapshot on Australia's children. One in six is living in poverty. More are in out-of-home care. The nation's Children's Commissioner will join me to discuss it. And as Australians increasingly fear they'll be replaced by robots, should governments guarantee workers' jobs?
A lot of governments and intergovernmental bodies are talking more and more about this kind of income protection.
An Australian man has been released in Afghanistan after being taken hostage by the Taliban more than 3 years ago. 50-year-old Timothy Weeks and his American colleague, 62-year-old Kevin King, were freed as part of a prisoner exchange for senior Taliban commanders. The pair was teaching English at a Kabul university when they were abducted at gunpoint in 2016. South Asia correspondent Siobhan Hinyu reports.
A hostage video released just 5 months into the more than 3 years the pair spent in captivity showed Australian teacher Timothy Weeks in a state of emotional distress.
We ask that the American government and the American University of Kabul please speak to the American government to ask for our exchange so that we may return home and be with our family again. To be with my father, to be with my mother and my brothers and sisters, so that we're not left here alone. I don't want to die here, not alone, not here.
Timothy Weeks' father, Mervyn Weeks, said he believed the Australian government had done enough to help his son.
Very relieved. All I want to say at this stage is that I want to thank all those who have supported us and prayed with us for this eventuality.
Mr. Weeks said he was yet to speak to his son himself and was unsure whether he'd be returning to Australia.
I don't know. I know what's in place, but I don't know what he will want.
Afghan journalist Bilal Sawari.
These prisoners have to be really shifted from house to house, door to door, because they fear night raids, they fear drone strikes. And life in a Taliban prison, which is usually a house or a house of someone, is not really one would really describe as comfortable.
Mr. Sawari says the US would have signed off on the prisoner swap, including the agreement to release three Taliban commanders who are part of the brutal Haqqani network, which has been responsible for some of the deadliest suicide bombings in Afghanistan in recent years.
But from here on, we will have to see whether we will see a clear reduction of violence, where we will see no more suicide attacks, for example.
There are hopes the prisoner exchange could be a step towards the first direct peace negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban. The US State Department issued a statement after the prisoners were freed, saying a political settlement is necessary for Afghans to achieve peace and to prevent international terrorists from ever again using Afghanistan as a platform. But this prisoner swap could also lead to an escalation in violence and hostage taking. Here's Afghan journalist Bilal Sawari again.
There are fears that from now on, militant groups can really continue to kidnap foreign or Afghan nationals, knowing that they could really have a deal with the Afghan government or with its Western allies.
And that's Afghan journalist Bilal Sawari ending that report from Siobhan Hinyu. Fire authorities in South Australia are bracing for catastrophic conditions today in seven regions across the state. 124 schools have been closed, as well as national parks, with a total fire ban in place. Adelaide is expecting 42 degrees today and very windy conditions. So bad, in fact, water bombing aircraft might be grounded. Brenton Eden is the Assistant Chief Officer of the Country Fire Service in South Australia, and he joined me just a few minutes ago. Brenton Eden, thank you for joining AM. New South Wales and Queensland have recently dealt with terrible fire conditions. They still are. How prepared are South Australians for today? And again, you're not in summer yet either.
No, South Australia facing its worst fire danger conditions for the last 4 years. It's 4 years to the month since South Australia experienced what was known as the Pinery Fire, where we lost two individuals in that tragic event and 85,000 hectares were burnt. We had six catastrophic warnings on that day. South Australia has seven today, and every fire ban area in the state is above severe. So this is our worst fire day in many, many years. The total fire ban has been in place since yesterday in an effort to ensure that the entire state is aware and prepared as much as it can be for the conditions we are likely to face today during what will be periods of very high temperatures up in the 40s, very strong winds, potentially reaching gale force and impacting across South Australia well into tomorrow morning. So a rather long duration shift of a very intense northerly wind system that won't leave South Australia until mid-morning tomorrow when it crosses the border into Victoria. So South Australia is at a heightened level of alert today.
The Adelaide Hills have had their fair share of terrible fire tragedies over the years. What is your biggest worry today if a fire breaks out, for example, in the Mount Lofty Ranges?
Well, look, it's the same for any populated area today. Under catastrophic conditions, those fires will not be able to be controlled by us in the early phase. So it's whether it is in the Adelaide Hills or the highly vegetated areas of the southeast, or even on the west coast, where only in the last 10 days we've had a fire very close to the community of Port Lincoln. And people may remember that around about a decade ago, we had the dreadful Wongaree fire over there. So any area where there is fuel on the landscape today, and by fuel we mean vegetation, it is at great risk of fire today.
A single truck ran out of petrol on the freeway in the Adelaide Hills a couple of weeks ago and it caused huge gridlock. If something like that happened today during a fire, how well prepared are people to deal with that?
Well, I think that was a good warning to the community that if their survival plan meant that at the time of a fire they intended to drive down the freeway, it's not the best choice for them. And that's why the fire services have always said your bushfire survival plan means you are taking action well before the event. So we would expect people in the Adelaide Hills today to have made the decision yesterday as to where they will be now. Most likely they'll be in the Adelaide metropolitan area, away from the Adelaide Hills. But it is not a wise decision at all to wait for a fire in the Adelaide Hills and then to move. They will not know which direction to go, which roads are closed either by fire. And of course, with high winds, we will see gum trees and other trees falling across roads, as we have seen in the last 2 to 3 weeks. So these are very dangerous conditions we face today. The community has been well warned, well prepared. We would hope they have taken action already to go to safer areas.
Brenton Eden, thank you very much for joining AM this morning and good luck with the conditions today.
Thank you so much.
And Brenton Eden, the Assistant Chief Officer of SA's Country Fire Service. Swedish authorities have dropped a rape investigation into Australian WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And the reason? Time. Alleged offending dates back to 2010 and prosecutors say the evidence has become weaker over that period. The move clears the way for US authorities to seek Assange's extradition from the UK over one of the biggest leaks of classified information in history. Europe correspondent Bridget Brennan filed this report.
An investigation 9 years in the making is now a case closed. Addressing the media in Stockholm, Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions Eva-Marie Pershing announced she's decided to discontinue a rape investigation into Julian Assange.
In such a situation, the preliminary investigation should be discontinued, and that is also what has happened today.
An unnamed woman alleges Assange raped her while she slept after they became friends in 2010. The investigation was dropped in 2017 because investigators couldn't interview Assange while he was holed up inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
They must resist. You can't resist.
But in April this year, circumstances changed dramatically when Assange was dragged out of the embassy and charged by police over breach of bail. Swedish authorities then renewed their investigation and since May, 7 witnesses have been interviewed. Eva-Marie Pershing says the victim is credible, but the corroborating evidence has weakened over time.
After the additional investigation and the investigative steps taken over the summer and autumn, it is now clear that the oral testimony in support of the statement given by the injured party has weakened. This primarily is because a long time has passed since the event took place. Memories fade for natural reasons.
Today's announcement means there won't be an international tug-of-war between Sweden and United States over extradition proceedings. Julian Assange's father is John Shipton.
We have no way of knowing whether Julian has actually received the news that the Swedish prosecuting service has seen the light and courageously dropped the allegations at last.
Mr. Shipton has been touring Europe seeking support for his son's case. He tells AM his son has been under immense strain as he prepares for a monumental extradition hearing scheduled for February.
I just saw him a few days ago. He is, not in the best condition, but still fighting for his life so that he won't be sent to the United States, never to return.
This week, a London court heard Assange was struggling to prepare for his case because the computers in London's Belmarsh prison are unsuitable. Assange is facing 18 federal charges in the United States over one of the largest leaks of classified information in history. This is Bridget Brennan reporting for AM.
The siege of a university in Hong Kong appears to be nearing an end, with some of the remaining student protesters making a futile dash for freedom. For almost a week, demonstrators barricaded themselves in the Polytechnic University as part of a renewed push in the territory's 5 months of unrest. Hong Kong's government says it won't give in to any of their demands, and protest supporters say their attempts to escalate their action wasn't in vain. China correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
Late in the evening, a group of protesters make a run for it. With police surrounding every exit to the university campus, there was little chance they could avoid arrest. One by one, the group of about a dozen students ran up a road, only to be tackled and pinned down by heavily armed police. This was the end of one of the most dramatic stages of Hong Kong's half-year revolt. What started as thousands of protesters blocking off a major campus armed with petrol bombs and rocks ended peacefully, with most of the remaining holdouts giving themselves up throughout the day. A small group of supporters, some with friends inside the campus, waited outside, yelling at each person arrested to say their name so they could organise lawyers for them. A woman, who only wanted to be called Iris, said she came along to show detained protesters they have support.
I was here seeing the students the week before. They're trying to do whatever they can to protect our city together, not for their own interest. Although they can't hear my voice here, but at least when they come out, and still can give them some warmest feeling.
The siege at Polytechnic University was part of fresh momentum for the Hong Kong protests. Having started in June in opposition to an extradition law that could have seen criminal suspects sent to mainland China, the movement has changed into more of a constant rebellion. Criticism of protester methods, including the use of petrol bombs, has increased. But another supporter present outside the university, who didn't want to be named, says the protesters' actions in confronting the police weren't in vain.
Even they surrendered, they got injured, and some people got depressed. But I think now people are more than ever united.
The end of the week-long standoff marks a peaceful turn after two brutal weeks of clashes that came after a police shooting. But if anything, anger towards police has only deepened. Video of officers kicking a man in the head during an arrest has circulated widely. Even the small group of supporters outside the campus were threatened with pepper spray when they argued with a member of the riot squad. As the siege shows, police will ultimately win each small battle with protesters. But the bigger fight for the heart and soul of Hong Kong has well and truly been lost by authorities. This is Bill Birtles outside the Polytechnic University in Hong Kong for AM.
30 years ago this year, the Convention on the Rights of the Child came into effect. While Australia's 5.5 million kids mostly live happy and healthy lives, a new scorecard out today recommends more than 80 changes that governments should make to fulfil the treaty commitments and improve living standards for the nation's poorest and most disadvantaged kids. Megan Mitchell is the National Children's Commissioner. She spoke with me a short time ago. Megan Mitchell, thanks for talking to AM. Your agency surveyed 22,000 children and spoke with 450 in coming up with this report. Do kids feel like they're being heard?
Oh, well, Sabra, that was one of the areas where they felt that was least true for them, being able to have a say. They also felt that they couldn't get access to accurate information and that they weren't always treated fairly. Those were the rights that were least true for them.
Your report finds that one in six children lives in poverty. The rate of kids in out-of-home care has increased. One in five parents say they can't afford medical treatment for their children. How can this be the picture in modern-day Australia?
Well, our report, which is a scorecard, a little snapshot of how we're going in meeting the rights of children that we've promised them under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, does show that most kids in Australia grow up happy and healthy, but there are significant groups of children who don't do well, like those you've talked about. And we really need to be doing much, much better for those children. Some of the data in the scorecard is pointing in the right direction, but for many children, we need to work much harder to wrap around strategies and plans to ensure they're lifted out of poverty, that we reduce the rate of homelessness of children and that we stem the flow of children into the care system.
You've found that the National Disability Insurance Scheme is failing some children. How and how urgent is it that it be fixed?
Well, some children do benefit from the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and that's a great thing. But there are really a lot of concerns about its implementation, that some younger children in particular are screened out of the system or don't meet the eligibility criteria. And whereas in the past they were accessing services, they're now not accessing services.
Yeah, I think you found that a significant number of children with hearing problems aren't being covered.
And children with FASD as well, fetal alcohol syndrome, and they're not covered as well. There are many areas on the autism spectrum also that aren't covered under the disability scheme. And so we really need to be looking at ensuring that all children who could benefit from the scheme do benefit from the scheme and their families.
We heard on AM last week about 35 children in the child protection system in Victoria who took their own lives. Another report on the Northern Territory found its system of child protection was flawed and uncoordinated. They're terrible indictments, aren't they?
Well, I'm very concerned about children's mental health and our incapacity to meet their anxieties and address their mental health needs. Suicide remains the leading cause of death for Australian children aged between 5 and 17, and that equates to at least one child taking their lives every week and more than 13 admissions to hospital every day. It's absolutely shocking. It's such a tragedy that young lives are being lost in this way. And there's more than 13 admissions to hospital every day as a result of self-harming. I don't think the public understands the enormity of this issue for children. We really need, you know, targeted mental health services for children at a much earlier age.
The Commission's made more than 80 recommendations in this scorecard. None of it is binding on any government. Some might say it sounds like the Commission is a toothless tiger. How will this bring about change?
Well, I hope people can use this scorecard to advocate for some or all of the recommendations in it. I think it does give a good overall picture of where we're at and the things we're doing well and where we need to do much more for kids. It really is a collective responsibility of the Australian community to get behind the recommendations in this scorecard.
I'd like to ask you about the Australian children being held in a detention camp in northern Syria. Their extended families in Australia would like them repatriated here. Are you satisfied with the government's stance on this? Is it doing enough to protect these children and bring them back?
I think we need to. I understand the government's, you know, concerns about security, but these are children. They didn't choose to be there. They're innocent victims of adult actions. And I really think we need to be working much harder to bring these children back to Australia so that they can have a good life.
Should the government be working harder on this?
I believe they should. I understand that they are working on it, But I think we need to get those children out of there as soon as possible. That's no life for these kids.
Megan Mitchell, thanks for talking to AM.
Thank you.
Megan Mitchell is the nation's Children's Commissioner. And the Commission mentioned there the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Today, the Federal Government Services Minister, Stuart Robert, is expected to announce a review of the pricing system used to pay for services provided under the NDIS. It follows pressure from disability service providers. Three quarters of them complain that they can't continue offering services under the current pricing regime, and half of them say they'll struggle to cover their own costs. With more, here's Gavin Coote.
Erin Reardon considers herself a big supporter of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, but worries about whether her local service providers are financially viable.
It's a struggle when families can't access the services to use the funding to support their child.
Her son Angus was diagnosed with autism before the NDIS was rolled out in their hometown of Goulburn in southern New South Wales. In the last couple of years, she's seen local organisations struggle to remain afloat. Some have scaled back their services or shut down completely.
Even some local services now have closed their books because they just don't have enough therapists or health professionals to deal with the inundation.
Yeah, it's just frustrating because, you know, because I'm sick, it just makes things a little bit more complicated.
Karen Dexter is battling cancer and just wants the best for her daughter, who has Down syndrome. But she says finding that's no easy task.
I think there's a lot of things that the NDIA could do to make the NDIS function better. So I really think that it's about time they started listening.
But those in the disability sector warn that providers face becoming even more cash-strapped if nothing changes soon.
More than three quarters of our members are saying that prices are a challenge for them in terms of being able to provide services.
David Moody is the acting CEO of National Disability Services, the peak body representing service providers. Its State of the Sector report out today finds that of the almost 700 providers surveyed, only half expect to make a profit this year of 3% or more.
What many providers would do instead was to, if you like, cross-subsidise between more profitable elements of their organisation and the less profitable parts of their organisation.
David Moody wants the federal government to reconsider its pricing regime, which sets out how much providers are able to charge for their services.
Ensuring that we get an NDIS which delivers on its original promise.
Change to the system could be just around the corner. The Minister for the NDIS, Stuart Robert, will today announce a review of the pricing system. In a statement to AM, Minister Robert says it will aim to build certainty for service providers and look at options to cut their administrative costs. And Mother Erin Reardon firmly believes more certainty in the sector can only be a good thing.
It would be wonderful if there's, I guess, more time and resources and funding. The problem is, I guess, that we're missing children and now they're coming to school and they haven't had that early intervention.
That's Mother Erin Reardon ending Gavin Coote's report. Victoria's drinking water supply could be at risk by illegal logging by a company owned by the Victorian state government. Under existing laws, logging's not allowed along banks that are too steep because it could pollute waterways. A new report by the ANU has found Vic Forests is doing just that, illegally harvesting along some of the state's most important drinking water catchments. National Environment reporter Michael Slezak has this exclusive story.
Former logger Michael McKennell used to love working in the timber industry.
My family was involved in forestry, and for me it was a natural progression.
But he became disillusioned when in 2004 Vic Forests took over commercial harvesting in the state. Now he worries Vic Forests is ignoring its own rules.
Unless they've got the approval from the minister, they're clearly breaching their own guidelines.
Logging is banned on slopes steeper than 30 degrees along drinking water catchments because the loss of vegetation binding the soil can cause sediment to run off.
And that's because you lose the root systems of the plants and microbial biomass that holds soil together and aggregates it.
Elle Bowd is a PhD candidate at the Australian National University and is an expert on soil erosion.
Big disturbances like logging and like fire on steep slopes can cause these erosion events, and that means sediment can be deposited in waterways, and that can ultimately impact the quality of the water.
The allegations levelled against Vic Forests have been backed by a report from the Australian National University, given exclusively to the ABC. Landscape ecologist Dr. Chris Taylor is one of the authors of the report.
We analysed all the coupes that were cut here between 2019 this year and 2004, and what we found is roughly 44% of coupes cut contained slopes that breached 30 degrees.
Scientists examined 10 catchments in the Central Highlands of Victoria and, they allege, found widespread breaches in 7. They compared slope information from Geoscience Australia to satellite imagery from the European Space Agency. One area, known as the Thompson Catchment, supplies almost 60% of Melbourne's drinking water. There, scientists found more than a third of the areas logged by Vic Forests, 50 coupes in total, contained logging of slopes steeper than is allowed. Could it be a mistake?
Well, one or two instances, maybe, but where we're seeing nearly half of the coupes containing slope exceeding 30 degrees, you have to wonder.
Victoria's Office of the Conservation Regulator is now investigating the allegations, and Victoria's Environment Minister Lily D'Ambrosio says that office was created to strengthen regulations of the logging industry. In a statement provided to the ABC, Vic Forests said that it has complied with all the relevant laws.
Vic Forests uses high-resolution LiDAR data to determine the gradient.
Earlier this month, the Victorian government announced an end to native logging by 2030. Chris Taylor says there's not enough wood left to maintain the industry until then. And that's pushing Vic Forests into expensive and unlawful areas.
This is not ideal country to log. It's marginal. And it's also putting water catchment values at greater risk.
Yay News, Dr. Chris Taylor ending Michael Slezak's report there. The fear of robots taking away jobs is so great that many Australians want the government to step in as an employer of last resort, according to a new survey. The poll, commissioned by Unions New South Wales, found 80% of respondents thought automation would soon replace much of the work currently done by humans. Two-thirds of the respondents backed the idea of a work-for-all scheme. Barbara Miller reports.
When another restructure was announced at Perry Merrick's work, her heart sank.
When the talk starts about restructure, regardless of your position, you feel very nervous.
After 17 years at one of the big four banks, her role was declared redundant, and the 47-year-old took a package and left.
The first thing comes to my mind is always my children. How will I look after my family?
Increasing automation was partly behind the decision to cut the mother of four's role. A survey conducted by YouGov for Unions New South Wales found 80% of people think many current jobs will be replaced by robots or computers within the next 30 years.
We'll probably have people sitting at home having their groceries delivered by drones, ordering online. No money exchanging hands. I think it's going to be a very, very different world.
That's Mark Morey, Secretary of Unions New South Wales, ruminating on how life on a busy Sydney street might look in the future.
Is that just progress, though?
It is progress, but I think we know that one in three jobs in the next 15 to 20 years is going to disappear. One of the things we're calling for is for government to think about big picture, how are we going to ensure that people are engaged in society and their communities into the future?
The bold ideas that the union would like the government to consider include the introduction of a universal basic income, backed by half the survey respondents, or a jobs guarantee, where the government provided work for those who couldn't find it elsewhere, a proposal backed by two-thirds of the 1,000 people surveyed. Angela Knox is an Associate Professor of Work and Organisational Studies at the University of Sydney's Business School.
A lot of governments and intergovernmental bodies are talking more and more about this kind of income protection. I imagine it is going to become more important and something that governments will start to introduce in the coming years.
And the idea of the government as an employer of last resort didn't sound too far-fetched to some of those AM approached.
I agree. I think the more people that have equal opportunities and access to roles should be available to all.
Away from my grandchildren, we were just talking about this morning, how will my grandchildren, what sort of work situation are they going to be in?
If there's not as many jobs, should the government step in?
Definitely. Definitely. I think so.
Though not everyone agreed automation was that big a threat.
One job goes out the window, another one opens.
Perry Merrick is gearing up to start looking for another job. But it's not just the robots she's worried about replacing her.
There are many, many young people just out of university. And then you just think, look, you're middle-aged, how will you compete with them?
That's Sydney woman Perry Merrick ending Barbara Miller's report. That's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
So today is Trans Day of Remembrance, which means that vigils around the world, lists of trans people who've been killed this year, will be read aloud. Australia has one of the shortest lists in the world, which sounds like good news, but there's a lot more to this story.
Only two of the more than 3,000 globally recorded trans killings in the last decade happened in Australia. So is that a plausible figure? And if not, how do we find the rest of those names?
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.